This is Mike Causey. Welcome to Your Turn. I'm talking today with Tammy Flanagan. She is a world-class benefits expert. And as I said in the dead part of the show, which nobody heard, having Tammy here, it's like having when John Elliott is here. I could introduce you guys and then just leave the room. But I won't. Fascinating subject, getting ready to retire, or if you're retired, did you do the right thing, or is there something I could still do even though I'm 10, 15 years into retirement? And a story I like to tell happens to be true. A friend of mine worked for the GSA, not an athletic type, not an outdoorsman, but when he got ready to retire, he was going to move to Washington State from Washington, D.C. And I said, do you ski? Knowing he didn't, and he, no, nothing like that. And I said, well, how come you're moving? And he said, well, he was moving to a little town on the Columbia River in Washington State, which has no state income tax. And he would do all of his shopping, grocery, clothes, what have you, in Portland, Oregon, which has no sales tax. And that was the sole reason for his moving 30,000 miles, you know, away from family, friend. Now, there may have been other issues, too. Maybe he wanted to get away from some people. But I thought that's interesting, and I know you've seen so much of it, Tammy, is people have different mindset, what they consider as savings. So let me let you take it away, please.
Right. Yeah. Well, thanks, Mike, for having me on today. And that's true. In fact, we're in the early stages of retirement, my husband and I ourselves. And you know, my husband retired federal, and the whole idea was to move to Florida. So when I tell people that we've moved down to Florida, they all immediately say, oh, it's because there's no taxes. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was one of the factors why we decided to move to Florida. But I think the more important factor for us was, you know, the weather and the nice lifestyle down there and so many other things. So you do, you're right. You have to look at other things besides just focus on that one thing. It's almost the same thing like when we talk about the best date to retire. It's like people will retire on December 31st, no matter what, because we say it might be the best date to retire. And meanwhile, for them, they might live in Alaska and it's going to be dark for the next 4 months. Yeah. So, you know, you don't want to do that necessarily. So I think it is a matter of looking at the bigger picture and making sure everything is lined up. You're mentally prepared, you're financially ready, you have something to do where you're going or where you're staying. So I think it's a whole bunch of things put together. And I see that now as we do our pre-retirement seminars. You know, we have not just one speaker like me who talks about benefits, but we'll talk about benefits, taxes, financial planning, life after retirement, you know, keeping your health physically and mentally and emotionally. So really, pre-retirement planning is a lot more than just all about the money. And I think a lot of people just hyper-focus on that one narrow issue rather than looking at the bigger picture of, you know, what else is there beyond federal service or beyond the job that I'm doing in the government. So that's true. And when we do talk about taxes, though, you know, taxes is one of those things that a lot of people think when you retire, you're not going to pay taxes anymore. You already paid the taxes while you worked.
Or so they'll be a very low level.
Yeah, they'll be really low, or, you know, I'm going to be in a lowest tax bracket. I'll go from the 39% down to the 10% bracket. And hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if that happens, that means you don't have much income.
Yeah.
And I think most people today need almost the same net income after retirement, maybe even more net income after retirement than they needed when they were working. Because, you know, I hear people say this all the time, and it's true. You're going to have 50 or 60 more hours a week to spend it. And even if you volunteer, that's still going to cost money because you have to drive there, you have to dress, and you have to maybe buy supplies for what you're doing. So I think when you're thinking about planning financially for retirement, you have to consider the fact that there's the gross income, which is looking pretty good for many federal retirees, but then there's the net income because you still have to pay for your health insurance, you still have to pay taxes, you still have to pay your living expenses. So financial planning can be very simple in just understanding, you know, what do I spend and what do I bring in, but really look at those numbers realistically.
Well, you know, that's interesting you'd say that because there's a term in flying, particularly with fighter pilots and stunt pilots, it's called target fixation. And you think about something, you fixate on it, and you fly into it. And I think people have that in retirement, particularly with the taxes, but maybe other things. You said the neatest thing I've heard in a long time from a real person, and you said that since you'd retired, your husband was like the guy you knew in high school, which is a very, I think, flattering, romantic thing to say.
I'm not even sure if he realizes like how that shift in his personality has changed, but it's almost like he's just more relaxed now. He's not, you know, so worried about, you know, what's going on the next day at work. Now it's like, what's going to go on that we're going to do together, or, you know, how we're going to spend the day, and, you know, what's on my to-do list. So
I used to know somebody, we went to the beach all the time, and she said, when you cross the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, you cease being a type A.
That's right. Your blood pressure goes down.
And I got mad.
Everything kind of changes, yeah.
Okay. I mean, maybe just do the laundry list here. Mm-hmm. Thrift savings plan. Mm-hmm. I know you're obviously, and all financial planners are very big on this, but so many people don't realize, particularly if you're a career government worker and you've been in it, 401k plans are not required, although a lot of companies now are putting them in. Mm-hmm. But I don't know of a single person outside of the government who's in a 401k plan like the Thrift Savings Plan where there is any employer match.
Right. Yeah. So the basic premise with the TSP, of course, is the tax savings, being able to shelter income that you earn today from taxes. So major tax shelter. But then also for our FERS employees, which is most of the government now, is the matching, you know, what I call a deferred pay raise. You know, you may not be able to spend it today, but when you retire, boy, you've just doubled your investment just by saving 5% of your paycheck. So the matching on the thrift is wonderful. The only problem is I think a lot of people are so focused on just getting the match and keeping their money safe that they're putting too much of it in the G fund, perhaps.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is because when you look at the TSP statistics that come out, like every quarter they'll post the numbers, as of April, that's the last ones I saw, there might be some more recent ones, but I'm sure they're not too much different. 34%, which is the highest percentage of all the funds, is in the G fund.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at $500 million and you've got half, you know, not half of it, but a good third of it in the G fund, that seems a little bit high considering that we have so many young federal employees who still have so many years of investing in front of them that they're either not educated or not maybe brave enough to take the chance of investing rather than just saving. And I think there's a big difference
between that. I've heard financial planners refer to that as the sleep at night factor.
Yeah.
And some people just can't do it. You read that the Chinese 2 days in a row devalued their currency. Well, most of us, myself included, don't have a clue what that means.
Right.
But the market reacts and people say, I can't handle it if the Chinese are devaluing their currency. But you're doing this for the long haul. And as you and many other, all other financial planners have said, once you're retired and your income drops from the government and other sources, you need to keep up with inflation. And if you're in the G fund, you won't do it.
Yeah. Yesterday I was at Secret Service talking to a group of a lot of law enforcement officers there. And I guess either naive or brave enough to say something to one of the guys, you know, carrying a gun and a badge. I said, you know, one of the things about fear, because he was talking about the G fund and how safe it is and how people are afraid of investing. And I says, well, I think what causes fear in a lot of people is not knowing what's behind the door, not knowing what's, you know, if you turn the light on, you're not afraid. And I said, it's the same thing with investing, is if you don't understand what you're doing, you don't understand what is the stock market really, how does it work? You know, what companies am I investing in? If you don't really have that basic understanding, you're going to be afraid of the potential risk. But, you know, if you manage the risk and you understand it, so I think education is a big part of getting rid of that fear of the security that you feel like you're not going to have if you go outside of the G fund.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see a breakdown by sex and salary to see who's in the G fund and
yeah,
when that happens.
I've done some studies on gender investing because I do a lot of classes for women, you know, trying to get some information just for women who sometimes are a little bit more conservative in investing and maybe not quite as able to have that full career always. You know, sometimes women will take a step out of the workforce to either raise a family or to go back to school. So, you know, we talk more about that. But I think education, they're more willing to understand it and be open to being educated about it rather than just going headstrong into something.
Yeah, I think
something.
Women may be smarter investors. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the one thing they do
wrong...
They're
not afraid to ask questions.
Right, yeah. and take advice. But on the other hand, they tend to be more conservative,
right,
too. Right,
because we're the caregivers sometimes. You know, we have to be careful with everything, including
our money.
Well,
I knew someone who had a very large thrift savings plan account, very high up in government, and when the economy crashed in 2007, 2008, she finally literally said, I can't sleep at night. So she moved all of her money into the G fund. So she had been buying high all those years. And then when the market dropped, she sold, if you will, low and bought into the G fund. And I don't know that she ever went back. But for people who did nothing but kept investing as they had been, or kept investing in the stock market, they woke up one day and their portfolio had doubled.
Yeah, and it happens every time. I remember my mother-in-law a long time ago, I don't know how many years ago, one of the corrections in the market had occurred, and it was after her husband had died, and she was, you know, alone and on her own with what little money she had left. And she had a financial advisor who was helping her manage this money. And the correction occurred, and she looked at her statement and saw all the money go down in her investment. And of course, she put the blame squarely on the advisor. Yeah. She didn't understand that everybody who has those types of investments would have had the same thing. So she ended up taking the money away from the investment and the advisor, putting it in the bank. And that was about the time that the rates for bank accounts went down to next to nothing. So then she got worried again. So that sleep at night factor can be very unsettling unless you have the understanding and education.
Yeah. Let me just ask you some basics here. Health plans. We've got an open season coming up in November. It'll be an open season for a variety of things, but the health plans among them. And you have some advice for people about shopping for health plans. And I guess one of them is just because you've been happy with Plan X for low these many years doesn't mean it's the best one for you next year.
Yeah. So this open season should be very busy, I think, because we're going to have, for the first time since 1960, since FEHB started, we've only had two choices, either self-only or self and family coverage. So this year they're going to offer self plus one. So for families of two, whether it's you and a spouse or you and a dependent child, if that's just two of you, then you can switch to this new self plus one coverage, but you will have to take action during open season. You know, your agency or OPM is not going to notice that you're a family of two and just switch you over. So you'll have to actually participate. But besides that, I do think that a lot of us get comfortable with what we have and we don't want to shake up, you know, rock the boat or shake it up when it comes to our health insurance because we're so afraid we're going to make a mistake, or it just seems like such a complex decision that we just throw our hands up and say, forget it, let's just stay with what we have. But I think that many people are in a plan that is probably not serving them as best as it can. And as you were talking before about federal employees having so many wonderful benefits, but yet sometimes we neglect to take advantage of the choices we have. You know, we have 30 different plans to choose from in any given area of the country, yet we stay with the same plan for 50 years. So I think open season is a wonderful opportunity. You got a month to think about it and do a little bit of research.
And the government will, in many cases, sign up for the Washington Consumer Checkbook.
Yeah,
so you can
we
do
have
it online,
on
and you can
show.
Do it on government time, too. And, and we'll have Walt Francis for a number of shows on that.
We have plenty of information out there. The health fairs, you know, are available for people to go down and ask questions. And OPM, on opm.gov, there's a wonderful tool. If you go to insurance and go to choose a plan, there's a map of the United States, and you click on your state, you'll see all the plans available. You can visit their website.
It's a wonderful tool.
Yeah, I find it fascinating.
And the government pays 72 cents of every dollar in premium, pretty much. Yeah.
I mean,
for everybody, Blue Cross Blue Shield is the most popular, I think.
Absolutely.
I think about half the people more than half are in it. But there are two different Blue Cross plans, and one they're very similar. One, price-wise, is a lot better than the others, particularly for retirees.
And there's the basic and the standard option.
And they tend to stay in the standard when maybe some should be in the basic.
Some people could do well with the basic.
Okay, I dealt with this last week with John Elliott, but Medicare Part B, you know, the to be or not to be question. And there are some people who, there's one school of thought that says don't take it. Save the money and then use that money if need be, if you have medical emergencies. There's another school that says it's a good deal.
Yeah, I tend to be in the school that says take it because two reasons why I feel that way. One is because you don't know what's going to happen in that last third of your life. Let's say by the time you're 65, you're two-thirds of the way through, right?
Yeah.
So in that last third of life, there's a much bigger likelihood that you're going to develop a chronic illness or a couple of chronic illnesses before the end of the road. And Medicare specializes in the needs of elderly illnesses. You know, they have a whole catalog on durable medical equipment and on physical therapy. As long as your doctor says you need it, they're going to help you pay for it. So I think one of the reasons why I feel that Medicare is so good for our retirees is because you're going to pick up benefits that, believe it or not, your federal plans won't cover as generously. The second reason is because many of your federal plans will give you incentives to join Medicare. They're going to waive your deductible. They'll waive your co-payments and co-insurance. So you end up paying the Medicare premium, but then you pay nothing else. You know, everything else is covered 100%. The only thing you'll pay out of pocket would be your prescription copays. And if you're careful about shopping for prescriptions, you'll get discounts there as well and won't have too big of a bill. So I do feel like Medicare is worth looking into when you turn 65 if you're retired. If you're still working, you can save a lot of money by staying just with your FEHB plan, whichever one you're in, and then just delay Medicare until after retirement, because there's no penalty if you enroll late, as long as you have current employer-sponsored health plan, not retiree coverage, but as long as your health insurance is coming out of a paycheck rather than a retirement check, you can delay Medicare enrollment. So for our employees who work beyond age 65, that's a big savings.
Right. Okay. And so it is belt and suspenders. I use the example all the time, but it happens to be true. My mother was a longtime government worker. She had federal health insurance. She had long-term care insurance through an outside company, not the government program. Mm-hmm. And she had Social Security. And when she was always very healthy, took good care of herself. But the last 2 years were really bad. Dementia. She had to be put into a assisted living place. But thanks to her buying long-term care insurance and having these other things, there was very little out of pocket for us, the family.
Right.
Remember, and that was, as I think you've said it before, but long-term care insurance is the eternal Christmas gift for your children or the people who will take care of you.
Right, because I think you're right there, because it's more than just protecting your finances, it's protecting your family. Because 80% of long-term care statistically is done in the home by family mm-hmm. caregivers. So if you can provide them a resource to hire someone to come in, maybe for one shift and give you a break, there's something to be said for that. So again, it's not just about the finances. You have to look at the whole picture.
The quality of life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the place she was in, as she said, she liked everything except the old people, which she were one. But, you know.
You never realize. In your mind, you're not.
It was a beautiful place and kind of place you would live in if it weren't for the circumstances.
That's exactly.
Okay. Tammy, go on. You have a theme here about found money.
Yes, found money.
We're going to talk about that in tomorrow's column. But
okay, yeah, what we talked about today.
Yeah,
so I've written about this before, and I think a lot of federal employees are missing out on ways to bring in more net income or free up some money that you may have not even realized you had access to. One of the things is we talked about the TSP being a wonderful tax shelter, but insurance is becoming a wonderful tax shelter as well. Federal employees get to enjoy paying for their health insurance with pre-tax dollars. However, retirees don't get that benefit because you pay after tax for your health insurance. But the one thing that both employees and retirees could take advantage of, and I think it's worth looking into for a certain group of people, would be to establish a health savings account, which you can still have that in retirement. It's another way to shelter for a family almost $7,000 a year, actually more than that if you're over 55. So you can put this money in a health savings account, which is kind of like a health plan IRA, and the money can accumulate there. You can invest it, and it goes in tax-free, it comes out tax-free. There's only one catch, and that is you have to be in a high-deductible health plan to have that ability to save in a health savings account. But certainly worth looking at, and we do have those available within the federal program for employees to explore, and also retirees as well. The other thing you want to look at for saving money or freeing up some cash is reevaluating your insurance, especially life insurance. You know, as we get older, our life insurance gets more and more expensive, especially if we have FEGLI. So you want to look at that to see, are my needs still the same as what they once were years ago? And is FEGLI the best bargain for me and my family? Maybe I can go outside of the government program and shop around and see what else is out there and maybe save some money.
Yeah, okay. We got a phone call from James from Ohio, and he says, can a TSP life annuity be purchased at any time or only at the initial retirement date?
Oh,
and I'm so glad you're here for that.
So the TSP annuity for employees who have left federal service, you have access to all the withdrawal options in your TSP, and there's no timing for that. You don't have to do it the month after you separate. You can take a withdrawal option a month after you leave, 2 months, a year, 10 years after you go. The only time you're going to have to take a distribution of your TSP is once you hit that required minimum distribution age.
70 and a half.
Yeah, for most people, it's going to be 70 and a half or after you separate from federal service if you work beyond 70 and a half. So, yeah, so if you left federal service and you just left your TSP invested, you can do a one-time partial withdrawal. If you want to free some money up and take it out, you can take one chunk out and move it to an IRA and have it available. But the remainder of it, you can take a full withdrawal anytime after that. So you can say, I'll take the annuity maybe with part of my money, and then I'll take a monthly payment with the rest of it.
Yeah,
so
I think I know some people that have done that. Okay, mm-hmm. Lauren Larson, our producer, says we need to take a break. So we will take a break. Be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. She is a benefits expert par excellence, writes a column for Government Executive Magazine, is associated with the National Institute of Transition Planning, and you are a part-time retiree, now living in Florida, but frequently in the Washington area like today. Thank you very much for that. We're talking before, I got an email from a longtime correspondent, Emily, in Colfax, Washington. And we correspond frequently. And she said, why don't you get somebody on the show, and here we have you, to discuss how to encourage young feds to better invest for their retirement. I'm seeing a lot of youngish feds not saving very much and putting it in the G fund because it's safe. Money is such a taboo subject in our society. How do you tactfully bring up the conversation and promote saving at the minimum 5% for the free money match? And I must say that when I first joined Federal News Radio, which is more than a decade ago now, but I went around and asked a lot of the younger people, and they were all younger than me, what they were invested in, just looking at our choices here at the station. And almost none of them knew. Several of them said their husband did it, or some of the guys said, oh, I'm in this fund. And I wasn't playing gotcha, but right. I said, what does that mean? Right. And they didn't know. And
what's that, rotisserie oven, set it and forget it?
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
So people just put it in there and they leave it and they never go back and look at it. It's almost like beneficiary designation. You just fill them out once and the rest of your life you think they're going to stay the same. So with investing, I think, to me, because I'm not a financial planner, but I try my best to understand this because it's related directly to your benefits. So with the TSP, I think the wonderful thing is we're seeing a big increase in the life cycle fund participation. And if you don't know what the life cycle funds are, it's just taking those five basic funds, because the TSP only has five, GC, FS, and I. And they take those five funds, which are the government securities fund, the bond index fund, the big company stock in the U.S., the 500, the C fund, the smaller company stock, which is like 5,000 companies in the U.S., and then the overseas fund, the I fund. So it takes those five funds and it balances them according to your time horizon. And your time horizon means that's the date when you're going to start using the money. So you think, well, I'm probably going to work till I'm around 60 or 70 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood. Some people think they're going to retire younger than that, but in my 60s or 70s is probably when I'll start really needing to use that retirement money. So you pick a date that's going to be closest to that time horizon when you think you're going to start using that money that you're saving. And what happens with the life cycle funds, let's say that's 2050, because we have the L-2050 fund, which the time horizon would be somewhere around the year 2050.
Yeah.
So that fund is very heavy right now in CS&I, the three stock index funds, which are the highest risk comparatively to the other two. But over time, over the next 30 years, until we get 35 years, till we get between now and 2050, those funds are going to gradually shift, and it's automatic. Every 3 months, they're going to rebalance to become slightly more conservative. So by the time it gets to 2050, you're going to see 80% of your money in G and F, and only 20% of it in CS&I, where right now it's the opposite, 80% CS&I.
And a lot of people think that 80% in the G is way too conservative because of the point you made earlier about inflation and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but for someone who doesn't really understand investing, I think that's a safe way to do it without being in the G fund 100%.
Yeah, well, I would think too, and again, this investing is a very personal thing because of the fear factor. But I would think that if you think a fund is too conservative, if you think the year 2020 fund is too conservative because it's too much of it is in the G fund, get in the 2030
fund. Sure, there's nothing that says you have to pick any certain year.
You can be
year.
18 years old and get in a fund that doesn't mature or age out for 40 years.
I remember Penny Moran, you knew Penny,
sure.
right? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
years ago. She's retired now too, but she once said, looking at the overall statistics, she worked as the public affairs director mm-hmm. at the TSB or the training director. And she said they had a certain number of participants, and I'm sure they're still out there, who had 10% in G, 10% in C, 10%, each one of the funds, they just mm-hmm. spread it all across and figured, oh, well, that should work. One of those should perform well over time. But you have to have a plan. You have to understand at least enough of it to make a plan. So getting educated, and the TSP is a wonderful resource. If you go to tsp.gov, you could spend hours on there just watching YouTube videos.
They do a very good job. And their only function of that Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board is to make it work for you.
Right.
They're a government agency that works for other government workers.
That's right.
And Congress has said you have a fiduciary responsibility. You've got to keep it cheap. Keep it efficient, and
they really are doing something right.
Well, the guy that founded the Vanguard funds told Francis Rose and I on a radio show one time he wished he could get into the
Is that
PSP.
Bogle?
John Bogle. Yes.
Yeah, John Bogle.
Yeah, I always like to drop his name.
Yeah, I read something
investing.
The other day that Warren Buffett has on his will that his wife is to see John Bogle and have all of his wealth be invested in the index funds, just
okay.
like the TSP.
Excellent,
so,
yeah.
Even Warren Buffett likes index funds.
Yeah, the fees are so low, too.
Exactly.
The other thing about investing, and I'm thinking about people like me who maybe do the right thing for the wrong reasons. When the economy tanked and people were taking pay cuts, I mean, those were bad days.
It's hard, yeah.
I did nothing, mm-hmm. which is what I do best. Yep. When in doubt, I do nothing. I kept investing in our company plan here, and every year I'd get, or every quarter, or whatever, I'd get my statements, and the only growth was in what I had put in, but mm-hmm. there was no growth otherwise. And this happened for years, and I kept buying and buying, and then one day I opened it, and I thought I'd gotten the wrong list because it suddenly doubled. It
yep.
was, and so I did the right by doing nothing. I did the right thing. I bought low.
Yep.
I think so much of this is your mindset and your personality, because I've heard people say I lost a ton of money today mm-hmm. in the market, or I made money. The
right.
Dow is up, the Dow is down. Nothing happened.
No.
The day, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only day that counts is the day you cash out.
That's right.
Or what happened the day before that.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just the movement of the market affecting mm-hmm. what you're seeing in your account. But yeah, so people do have to be, I just think it really involves a lot of education, because even myself, the more I learn about it, the less fear I have, even with my own investing. Because when I left federal service, my retirement plan became save.
Yeah.
I don't have a thrift savings plan.
Right.
I don't have a FERS or CSRS retirement anymore, other than the one I married.
Mm-hmm.
But in my own savings account, it's investing. So I had to take the time to understand, what I needed to do to have something to show for the work that I've done over the last 30 years.
Well, and you get something like the thrift savings plan, and members of Congress are in it. I think people forget that. Members of Congress are in it. Federal judges,
yep.
Staffers on the Hill, so they want this to be the best possible
Absolutely.
System. And a large number of people who come into the federal government at with high salaries, federal judges, former judges, mm-hmm. lawyers who become federal judges, they bring their money, their outside money with them because they like what the TSP
yep.
has to
Simple
offer.
And, low
and
cost.
It's low administrative fees,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, it's not hard to manage it. It's easy, and it just makes sense for employees. And for young employees, I think one of the things they can do is to realize, number one, if you get a pay raise, I know they're few and far between, but you get step increases, you do get promotions if you're starting out in your career, and every once in a while you get a January pay adjustment. But take that pay raise and split it in two or three and put at least a portion of it as an increase to your contributions for retirement savings. If you have a young family, then you're going to also take maybe a portion and put it towards your kids' college, and take a portion and have fun with it, or give it away, or whatever you want to do with it. But at least take a portion of what you get a pay increase and start doing that. And you're going to find out it's not going to hurt as much as you think it is.
You won't miss it.
Because number one, it comes out of your paycheck. Number two, it's lowering your tax bill. So saving a dollar is only going to feel like saving maybe 70 cents. So you're going to feel less of a hurt by it than you think you are because of the pre-tax nature of the traditional TSP. Now, again, if you want to do the Roth TSP, you can save tax-free for the future, but you'll pay the taxes going in. So you do have to find out which one's going to work best for you.
At the beginning of the show, you said the magic words, best date to retire. Maybe I said them, but somebody said best dates to retire. And this catches everybody's attention because no matter how young you are, how far away you are from retirement, maybe you've never thought of it, when somebody says there's a best date that you know,
I want to know what it
how
is.
How come? And does it change from year to year? So what are we talking? We're in the middle of toward the end of 2015 now, going into 2016. I guess a lot of people in government know about the December 31 or the January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd mm-hmm. dates. Why are those good dates?
Yeah, I guess things have changed since we've been talking about this probably for 30 years mm-hmm. as well. And when we started to talk about it, we were talking mainly and probably exclusively to CSRS employees who had their whole retirement wrapped up in that government pension. When we're talking to FERS employees, we have to be a little bit more careful because you have the FERS retirement, which by itself for most employees is not enough to live on. So they might be timing, depending on their age, they might be timing their FERS retirement, their Social Security benefit, and maybe even starting to withdraw their TSP. But when you and I talk about the best date, and this is really for all federal employees, you really have to pick the date you want that FERS retirement or CSRS retirement to begin, because that's going to give you your insurance benefits and all the basic needs that you're going to have in retirement. The other things can get added in later. The Social Security can come later and the TSP withdrawals. So here we're talking just about picking the date for your FERS retirement or CSRS retirement. So when you asked about the end of the year, traditionally, and still to this day, a lot of federal employees do retire. The biggest surge of retirements occurs at the end of the year. And it's mainly wrapped around the accumulation of annual leave. Because as most federal employees know, you can only carry over 240 hours of annual leave per year. So if you built up a lot of cash reserve in your annual leave, once you get to the new leave year, they're going to make you only carry over the 240 unless you're a SES or some other employee who can have a higher balance. Maybe you have some restored leave. But in the year that you retire, you carry over the 240. But then during that last year that you work, if you work the entire year all the way up to the right to the end of that leave year, you can save up your accumulated leave, which is for many employees near retirement, 8 hours of pay period. So that's another 200 to maybe 208 hours. So if you saved it all up and you didn't take any annual leave that last year you worked, you can cash in maybe 440 or 448 hours, multiply that by your hourly pay rate, just take your annual rate, divide it by 2,087 hours, and multiply those number of hours of leave by that annual rate, and that's your gross value of that lump sum annual leave, which you're going to get in the next year for tax purposes. You know, you can claim it on 2016's tax, not 2015.
When your income will probably be lower.
Right. Yeah. And you might think, well, why would I want all that mm-hmm. leave for? Why not just take the leave? Well, you want the lump sum because it's going to give you some instant cash. Maybe not instant the day after you walk out the door, but within 6 weeks of retirement, you should get your lump sum accumulated leave, which is going to give you a little reserve of cash to live on while you're deciding, do I want to start my Social Security? Do I want to start bringing my TSP money out? Am I going to start a second career? Just gives you a little cushion of cash while you're waiting even for that first civil service or first retirement check to come in, because initially you may not get
months.
A check in a month or two. And even when you do start getting checks, they may be interim checks, which are a little less perhaps than what you're real check is going to be, and certainly less than what your salary was when you left federal service.
I want to ask you more about that, mm-hmm. but we need to take a break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan. Tammy is a columnist for Government Executive Magazine. She's with the National Institutes of Transition Planning. Recently semi-retired, dividing her time between the D.C. area and Florida, and as ever cranking this stuff out. Tammy, there's so much to talk about in the retirement planning. Do you have sort of like bullet points?
Of things that people should do to get ready to retire?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, when we teach, when I teach the benefits, and my specialty is federal benefits, so I focus on the SERS and the FERS, basic benefit and Social Security insurance, TSP. So what I tell people, and I think this is a surprise for many employees until they find out that it is an issue for them, is that the starting point is to make sure, you know, as far as your FERS and your CSRS retirement goes, make sure that your service credit, your service history has been fully documented and is creditable. Is I find this every single week I'll meet someone, like for instance, last week a woman wrote to me and she said that she had put in a request for a retirement estimate and she was planning to retire next year. She was going to have, you know, 31 years of service. She's 58 years old. Everything was going to be fine because she knew when she started. She knew how old she was. So it's like, I just wanted to get the estimate. Well, it came back and it said she only had 28 years.
Yeah.
And she's like, how can this be? How can I only have 28 years? I've been here 31 years. And when she realized that when she was first hired, she was not covered by FERS.
Okay.
She was a temporary, even though she was hired in 84, she thought that just automatically became FERS, but it was temporary service. It never had retirement coverage. And then a later time in her career, after 1990, she had another temporary appointment for about a year. That didn't even count. At least the old one, the one in 84, she could pay a deposit and get credit for it. But here she was, you know, ready to walk out the door, not knowing that 3 years of her career were in jeopardy of not even being counted for retirement and even eligibility for retirement. So as angry as she was at not knowing that, she was very grateful to at least find it out before she did try to walk out the door and learn that she wasn't even eligible for full benefits.
Well, you know, you were talking about lump sum annual leave before and retiring at the end of the year and getting up to 400 and something hours, 440, big chunk of money, big chunk of change that could be invaluable because if you don't want to hit your TSP account, many federal workers retire and don't touch it for 10 years.
Right.
They let it ride. They, particularly if you're under civil service retirement with that very generous, comparatively speaking, annuity. But if you're 3-6 months, a year before you start getting your full benefit, it would be a shame to have to tap your TSP really for nothing. You'd have to do it to stay alive, to pay the rent and eat, but it would be something you didn't have to do if you had a large lump sum annual leave check to live off of.
That's right. Yeah. Now, if you're someone who says, I just have never been able to save up leave, but I think I will want to have some money available when I first retire, one of the things you could do, I don't know if this is necessarily recommended, but it certainly could work, is you could borrow from your TSP account before you separate, and you don't have to pay the loan back. You can just declare it as a taxable distribution. So depending on your age, you can borrow up to $50,000 of your TSP money. That, again, would give you a cushion of cash for when you first retire. And if you don't pay it back, you just simply declare that income for the year that you received the loan. So that's an option for some people who might be up against a wall saying, I don't want to necessarily take a withdrawal from the TSP. So a loan is not a withdrawal. And so that wouldn't affect your ability to later on take a partial distribution or to take a full distribution later.
Because I was thinking, what's the difference?
But there is a difference because you're limited to one partial withdrawal. And there are some employees who are working past age 59 and a half who can do an in-service withdrawal. But if you do that, that counts as your one partial distribution, where a loan wouldn't necessarily count against that option to later on take another partial distribution.
Traditionally, federal workers have been able to and have retired at a younger age than most people in the private sector. A lot of reasons for that. Yep. A lot of private companies don't have a retirement plan. But of those that do, the federal workers tended to retire 3 or 4 years earlier. That was under the civil service retirement system. Jason Miller, our managing editor here at Federal News Radio, gave me some interesting stats from the government, and it's just chock full of things. But one of them is the average retirement age has gone up about two years and some months just in the last couple of years. And I'm thinking, is that because of the pay freeze? Is it the recession? Is it the job market outside? Is it all of the above, none of the above? And part of it could be that many of the people who are retiring now are under the FERS system.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. I think a lot of people are a little bit more concerned because you're more in control of your retirement under FERS, meaning that the money that you've saved in your TSP account is going to play a role in your ability to be comfortable financially in retirement. So I think people are just trying to make sure they have a nice, cushion there before they make that step into retirement. It's a little bit more fear.
Great. Tammy Flanagan, thank you so much. We're going to be doing this again next month. Have a good week, everybody. So we're sorry for the glitch at the beginning. See you next Wednesday.